Hello, I'm Kirsten Moy. I'm the director of the Economic Opportunities Program here at Aspen, and just wanted to welcome all of you this afternoon to what we know will be a fascinating conversation. It's the third in the tutorials in the series, What is Well-Being? And I have to say, everybody here looks very healthy, so I think you must be attending all the sessions. It's generously sponsored by Insight Venture Partners. And it's odd for me to introduce someone who is so well-known. I think all of you actually know Dr. Ornish. I think through the years we've all read his books, attended his media presentations, looked at his research. So I'm simply going to turn the mic over here to him and the session and look forward to what I know will be a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind introduction. And it's appropriate that I'm giving a talk on suffering as a catalyst for transformation because I just got some really bad news, so I'll get a chance to practice what I preach. So if I seem a little bit distracted, that's why, but I'll get into that later. I also want to thank Jerry Murdoch for sponsoring this as part of the Insight Venture Partners. For the last 30 years, I've directed a series of studies showing first that heart disease could be reversed by changing diet and lifestyle, and more recently that the progression of prostate cancer and by extension breast cancer can also be stopped or reversed by making similar changes. Diabetes, hypertension, obesity, arthritis, a number of other things, most chronic diseases can be affected by making these kinds of changes. But if you talk with the people who've gone through these different studies and programs that we've done, they'll often say things to you like, I got interested in this because I wanted to unclog my arteries, but what kept me in it is that I'm less worried if my arteries are more open because I'm more open. Or they'll say things like, you know, having a heart attack was the best thing that ever happened to me. And you go, what, are you crazy? How can that be? And they say, well, that's what it took to get my attention. That has caused me then to make changes in how I live my life and how I relate to my loved ones and how I live and eat and do meditation and get into other spiritual kinds of practices that ultimately have made my life so much more joyful and so much more meaningful that had I not had this heart attack, I never would have done that. And so along the way, we've really learned what really works to motivate people to make and maintain changes, because change is difficult. But if you're in enough pain, if you're suffering, whether it's physical from a heart attack or other physical illnesses or emotional or more often the case, both, then the suffering itself can be a catalyst for transformation. It's kind of like you go, well, it may be hard to change, but boy, I'm in so much pain, I'm ready to do just about anything. And then when you begin to make these changes and you start to feel better, not only the angina, the physical chest pain gets better, but the deeper issues that are harder to measure but are often more meaningful, they also get better in ways that are ultimately profoundly transformative for most people who go through that. And so what I would like to talk about today is, what are some of those issues? How can we learn to do that? And why bother? And so before I get into that, I wanted just to show you a brief clip. We've trained through our... I started a nonprofit institute back in 1984, so 20, 30, what is it? Long time ago. And 22 years ago. And we've trained hospitals around the country in this reversing heart disease program, 10 of which, surprisingly, are in West Virginia as part of this demonstration project we've been doing with some of the major insurance companies like Mutual of Omaha and Blue Cross Blue Shield, and more recently with Medicare, for the last 8 years with Medicare. And so this was in one of the hospitals in West Virginia, and they held a press conference just to talk about some of the benefits. And this is one of the guys who went through the program, and it's about a five-minute or so excerpt, but since we've got, you know, an hour and a half or so together, I wanted just to show you this. Not only he'll first talk about the physical improvements that he had, but then he'll talk about some of the other dimensions that I think are really meaningful, and that's what I want to focus on when we get started. So if you could show the first DVD, or the first, the only DVD, that would be great.
Ended up in the ICU and got some very discouraging news from my cardiologist. He said, your bypass grafts are totally occluded and your vessels are small in disease and we don't recommend surgical intervention. Well, that didn't give me a whole lot of choices. My family practice physician said, I hear that the hospital is going to begin a new program for reversing heart disease. Hey, I listened. Well, that was before the program really got formulated, and I found out who was doing it, the health connection there, and my friend Tony, and I went over and started banging on her door, and I said, hey, I want into this. It's the only chance I've got. And she must have liked me or something because she let me in. Anyway, it's been a real rewarding experience. The program itself is a well-rounded program that pretty well meets the needs of every aspect of your life if you let it, and if you choose to. In case you haven't noticed, we live in a partially hydrogenated world. I never knew there was so much of that stuff around. But when I went to the diet, I don't like to call it a diet, it's a way of eating that is far surpasses anything I'd had before. When I got used to that and started going in that direction, I began to see some real transforming physical things happening to me. First thing is I've lost 50 pounds. If you, anybody looking for an inexpensive wardrobe, let me know. The seventh week that I was in the program, my angina disappeared. Just 7 weeks in. I thought that was a little bit too good to be true. But it was. And things like that have been happening ever since. I'll just give you my vital statistics here. My ejection fraction has increased from 45% to 61%. I lost 50 pounds. My triglycerides are down from 819 to 93. My cholesterol is down from 243 to 110. My HDL is up from 27 to 38. My PSA even went down. I'm no longer using a cane or a wheelchair. In November of 2001, I was using a cane to walk with, and I had to have the humiliating experience of riding a wheelchair around Walmart. Now, I didn't like that. I wasn't going to settle for that. I knew there must be a better way. And thank God I found a better way. I no longer have to take my diabetes medication. In fact, my total medication has been reduced by 75%. I had trouble getting to my mailbox without having chest pain. But now I'm walking at least 2 miles a day. I ride my stationary bike anywhere from 8 to 10 miles a day. At our American Heart Association health walk here a few months ago, I walked 2 miles in that and felt like the Energizer Bunny. I still wanted to keep going. But it has been a rewarding experience. Now, these statistics are fine, and I have certainly worked hard in trying to get them to this point, but the most wonderful part of the program is the quality of life that I'm able to enjoy now that I never thought I'd be able to again. Instead of a fear of dying, it's been replaced by a gratitude of living. This is an emotional thing. It's not something that we take lightly. And I am so thankful that I am a part of this program. And it's certainly been a lifesaver to me. To me, the Ornish program in United Hospital Center has given a whole new meaning to heartfelt thanks.
Any comments or questions about that before we
any questions or comments about that before we continue? Yeah.
I guess I do. It's mainly why I came here. I was run over by a car last year, given a 2% chance to live, so be glad to hear it, because here I am. I've gone through similar feelings to what this man described, although what happened to me was not ill health. It was an external thing that broke almost every bone on the right side of my body, fractured my skull. And I'm wondering... if any part of your program, because I'm still in a huge amount of pain, and can help somebody who was attacked by a big gas-guzzling car as opposed to a heart. Thank you.
Well, it's a good question, and it's a chance for me to kind of leap into, it's Viktor Frankl wrote a book many of you probably read called Man's Search for Meaning a long time ago about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp. And he wondered, why is it that some people thrived in those environments and compared to others who, were overcome, thrive in the sense that they survived. And it wasn't always the sickest or the most frail people that died. It was often the ones who seemed to be the healthiest. But he found that those people who could make some kind of meaning out of their suffering had a real survival advantage. And so it's not that I would ever go up to someone who was hit by a car or who had a heart attack and say, oh, how wonderful, you have this opportunity for transformation and finding meaning. I mean, the proper response would be a punch in the nose. But at the same time, there it is, that bad things happen, as happened to you, as happened to him and to others. And so to the extent that we can find meaning in when bad things happen, it makes them more tolerable. And in its best case, it can be transformative. Not that we look for suffering, but that when it happens, we can make something good that can come of it. And part of the good that can come of it, the easiest to start with, is that, as I mentioned, change is difficult. But any kind of change, even good change can be stressful. But if you're in enough pain, suddenly the idea of changing becomes more appealing. And so there's an opportunity there. Pain and suffering are not the same thing. Healing and curing are not the same thing. Pain is more of a physiological response. When you break a bone or when you burn your hand, your nerves send impulses to your brain and through your spinal cord that tell the brain that this is not a good thing. There's survival value there, so we learn not to put our hands in hot flames, for example. But your experience of that can be on a wide spectrum. For example, studies of people who have rheumatoid or osteoarthritis find that the x-ray findings don't really correlate with how much suffering a person has. That there's obviously some correlation, but it's a wide spectrum of reactions that people have. So that one person might have, a really intense sense of suffering from the same amount of physiological discomfort that may not be nearly as much to someone else. And there are techniques and tools that we can use to help reduce the amount of suffering, even though the pain impulses are not diminished. You may not have any cartilage between your two knees, but one person may experience that as intense suffering, and another person as a mild discomfort, even though the x-rays may look the same. And so yoga, meditation, and so on can be powerful tools for that. But to me, that they're most powerful, in the same way healing and curing are different. Curing is when the physical illness gets better. Healing is the becoming more whole. And so to the extent that in the case of someone like this, you could turn the this off now if you would. You often get both in the case of heart disease. We can show, and we have shown, using repeat arteriograms and PET scans and radionucleoventriculograms and thallium scans, that the amount of blood flow to the heart gets measurably better. The amount of blockages in the arteries can become measurably less. That's the curing, if you will, the physical changes. But the healing is the process of becoming more whole, and that's what I want to focus on here. And everything I really talk about will come back to your particular question, because I think it's really the key one that we're going to be talking about today. And that is, how can we transform our lives using suffering? How can we reduce our suffering, even which can often lead to curing, but not always? Sometimes the most profound healing is in the process of dying. And what do I mean by that? Well, you bring to, in its best case, people, you bring together a family, you bring together loved ones, people begin to put their petty differences in a different perspective when you're about to die. There's often forgiveness and things that can happen, the different techniques and so on that really all spiritual practices talk about. When you get past the things that people fight about, you know, the names and forms and languages and prayers and so on, ultimately, Aldous Huxley talked about there's a perennial wisdom. There's a spiritual basis that underlies the different ways that people like to categorize and divide each other. And to me, in my limited understanding, the spiritual basis is anything that brings us together and connects us to create a sense of connection and community and intimacy and union is healing. Even the word healing comes from the root to make whole. The word yoga comes from the Sanskrit, meaning union, to yoke, to bring together. These are very old ideas that we're rediscovering and finding how powerful they can be. And they're powerful in a lot of different ways that we've learned in our work that it's not enough to give people information and expect them to change their behaviors. If it were, nobody would smoke. Everybody knows smoking isn't good for you. You can see it on every package of cigarettes in the Surgeon General's warning. So you have to say then, well, why do people smoke? Why do they overeat? Why do they drink too much? Why do they work too hard? Why do they abuse substances? And I'd ask the people who went through our studies, and I'd say, these behaviors seem so maladaptive to me. Why do you do this? They'd say, Dean, you don't get it. You don't have a clue. These behaviors aren't maladaptive. They're very adaptive because they help us get through the day. They help us deal with our depression, our loneliness, our isolation. There's been a radical shift in our culture in the last 50, 60, 70 years. And we're only now beginning to appreciate the implications of that. And I wrote a book about this a few years ago called Love and Survival, which is the idea that anything that promotes a sense of alienation, isolation, and loneliness, depression, both lead to patterns of behavior. I mean, people say things like, I've got 20 friends in this pack of cigarettes, and they're always there for me, and nobody else is. You're going to take away my 20 friends? What are you going to give me? Or they'll say things like, when I get depressed, I eat a lot of fat. It coats my nerves and numbs the pain. Or that void that I feel, that emptiness, I try to stuff it with food. Or they use alcohol or other drugs to numb the pain. Or they work too hard. It's a more socially acceptable way of achieving the same goals to distract ourselves from our pain. Or they spend too much time on the internet or video games or television or movies. There are lots of ways we have of numbing or killing or distracting ourselves from pain or bypassing pain. But in our work, we say, wait a minute, the pain isn't the problem. The pain's the messenger. It's saying, hey, listen up, pay attention. You're not doing something that's in your best interest. And if we just kill the pain without listening to it and go back to doing the things that cause the problem without treating the problem, it's a little like going back to sleep while your house keeps burning. You know, you just clip the fire alarm, but you haven't put out the fire, so the fire just gets bigger, and then it becomes more of an issue. And so awareness, to me, is always the first step in healing. Because when you're aware of something, you can do something about it. When we make the connection between when we suffer and why we suffer, then the suffering itself can be a catalyst for getting our attention, saying, hey, listen up, pay attention. You're not doing something that's good for you, that's in your best interest. And then that can in turn motivate us to do something differently. And then when we make those changes and we see, wow, I feel so much better, not only the physical angina, but the deeper changes, as I mentioned before, that are more difficult to measure but often the most meaningful, then the suffering itself we look back on and say, yeah, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, but it was really necessary for me to get to where I am now. That's really made my life so much more joyful and meaningful. And in a way, all spiritual practices, again, from my limited understanding, are towards that goal. What they do is they quiet down your mind and body enough so you can experience more of an inner sense of peace and joy and well-being, and to realize that that didn't come from getting something we thought we needed, but rather because that's our natural state. And ultimately, it can take us to experience more of an inner sense of peace, which is really a very empowering thing to realize. And, you know, in talking to the people in our studies, they'd say things like, you know, I feel really lonely, I feel really isolated. If only I must be lacking something or I wouldn't feel this bad. If only I had more whatever. And the arena may differ, but the essence is the same. If only I had more money, more power, more sex, more beauty, more accomplishments, whatever, then I'd be happy. Then people would love me. Then I wouldn't feel so lonely. And then I'd be happy again. Now, that's the American, that's the way that most people in this country and most parts of the world think. Not everyone. But that, the whole advertising industry is based on the idea, buy this product, you'll be happy. You don't ever see an ad with somebody drinking a Miller Lite by themselves in a corner being depressed. You know, it's always in a group of people, you know, being happy and laughing and intimate, you know. People go into a McDonald's or a Burger King and they're with their families and they're all having a good time, you know, because that's that need for connection and community, in my experience, is a fundamental, powerful human need that is more powerful than the need to eat and breathe. You know, and study after study have shown that when you don't have that, that people who are lonely and depressed are 3 to 7 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely than those who have a sense of love and connection and community. Now, in part, it's because you're more likely to abuse yourself in ways we've talked about, to smoke and overeat and so on. But even when you control for all the known behavioral factors, there is a many-fold difference, more than cholesterol, more than blood pressure, more than anything. This is what really determines longevity, not to mention well-being. And yet it's something we don't talk much about in our culture. And so people say things like, if only I had more whatever, then I'd be happy. Now, once you set up that view of the world, however it turns out, you're likely to feel worse. And we don't think about it usually in that way. But why is that? Well, if I don't get it, until I get it, I'm going to be really stressed. Boy, I hope I get it. You know, I got to get it. It's really important. It's super important. All right. Now, until I get it, there's a lot of stress. We know that the stress comes in general. Stress isn't so much what you do. It's how you react to what you do. You can put two people in the same job. One thrives. One gets a heart attack. Why is that? Well, because it's how you react to stress that really determines whether it's going to be something. I mean, like if you're learning how to surf, you know, somebody might see a 10-foot wave and get wiped out and get, you know, broken bones, and somebody else might say, wow, that's the coolest thing, and they just surf along. So it's how you react to the environment, not the environment per se, that determines whether it's going to create healing or suffering and ultimately illness. So when you think that these things are going to make you happy, then until you get it, it's really stressful because the stakes go up. It's not just winning or losing. It's being a winner or loser that's on the line. And losers, you know, you feel like if I'm a loser, nobody's going to want to be with me. I'm going to be even more depressed. And depression is the real epidemic in our culture. You know, what's the number one prescribed medication in this country? Is it Lipitor? No. It's Zoloft, you know, and Celexa. Those are number one and two right now. So the antidepressants are the big causes, the biggest selling drugs. And yet it's something most people don't feel comfortable talking about because there's a stigma associated with it. I'll talk about what happened to me when I was in college in a few minutes. So when the stakes go up, if you really think that you're going to be a winner or loser, and winning means you're going to be loved and not feel lonely and depressed, and a loser means you're going to be even more depressed and even more lonely, then the stakes go up. So there's a lot at stake here. I've got to get it now. It's really important. So until you get it, there's stress. If you don't get it, there's really stress. If someone else gets it and you don't get it, then that's the worst, and you feel like it's a dog-eat-dog world. The more you get, the less there is for me. And, you know, it's a zero-sum game and, you know, kind of the Miller beer commercial. You know, you better get it while you can. But that's a profoundly unsatisfying way to live. But what's really sad is when you get it, Because then you think, wow, I got it, it's mine. And it's very seductive because you say, wow, I feel really good. But it doesn't last. It's like maybe 15 minutes or a day or a week or whenever. And then soon it's followed by, well, now what? It's never enough, you know. I mean, how many times have you thought, gee, if only I could just make $1,000 a month, I'd be happy. You know, when you're a kid or whatever. And then you do that and it's like, well, yeah, but okay, I don't still feel that much different. In fact, I feel kind of worse because it didn't really bring me the lasting peace and joy and happiness that I thought it would. Well, maybe that will. And so then the process continues. Well, that didn't do it, but maybe this will. So it's either now what, it's never enough, or so what, big deal. It doesn't provide the lasting meaning that we thought it would. And people say things like, the letdown that comes from accomplishing or getting something that I thought would make me happy is so great, I make sure I've got 12 projects going at the same time, and then I can just move on to the next one. Or people say things like, the view from the mountain I've climbed was, I can't even enjoy the view from the mountain I've climbed, I'm already looking over the next one. You know, it's never enough. And so what we try to do is to say, and sometimes the people who actually have a lot of money and power and influence, like many of the people here at this conference, are the most depressed because they can't kid themselves into thinking, oh, if I just could get more of this, then I'd be happy. Because they already have much more than you ever thought you'd ever need or want or even get. And you may not, and you may find that it didn't really bring you what it thought it would. I mean, the people who love you despite those things, not because of them. And often it just creates jealousy and resentment, which is its own kind of loneliness. Or you find that, wow, I got all these things. It was better when I thought they might bring me happiness, because at least I had the illusion that they might. And now that I found out that they didn't, where do I go from here? Now it's profoundly depressing. Is this making sense at all? Is this resonating with what you... Okay, so in that context, where does illness and suffering fit in? Okay. Now, I got profoundly depressed when I was in college. That was my doorway to all of this. And I don't know if you want, I can tell you a little bit about my own story. I don't want to assume that you want to hear it, but would that be... Okay. Well, I went to a really small competitive school called Rice University in Houston, where half the student body was, because I grew up in Texas, was either the valedictorian or salutatorian of their class. And I always did well in public high school, but I never had to work very hard. And when I got to college, my college roommate was one of the four people in the country who scored a perfect score in his SATs. And my organic chemistry professor, I was convinced, had decided to go from Nazi Germany to Houston rather than Argentina and be my organic chemistry professor. And he started the first day of class by saying, look to the person on your left and your right, and one of you won't be here by the end of the semester, and that this is the most important course you'll ever take as far as getting into medical school, and I really wanted to be a doctor. And so I thought, you know, if I want to be a doctor, how can I do well in this course? And he taught the course in such a way that there was no textbook, there was no conceptual basis to it. It was all in the sense of rote memory, which has never been my strong suit. And so the more I worried, the harder it became to study, and the harder it became to study, the more I worried. So I got into this vicious cycle where I actually couldn't sleep for like a week straight. And my college roommate, of course, who had scored a perfect score in his SATs, never had to study at all and always made perfect scores. And they graded everybody under a curve from A to F. And you have to remember, most of the people in this school, they never made anything less than an A. Suddenly people, a third of the people are making Cs and only 10% are making As and so on. So it was really stressful. And I got to a point where I was so depressed and so agitated that I couldn't sleep for a week straight, which is enough to, that alone will make you crazy, which is why they keep prisoners, awake, because it makes you crazy when you can't sleep. And so I remember sitting in physics class one day, in chemistry class, and I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll just kill myself. You know, it's like, then I'll be at peace, because that's what we all want, is to be peaceful and happy. I thought, why didn't I think of that before? It's like, because I was stupid, that's why, And I was ready to do that, and I went to the college psychiatrist and said, I'm really stupid, I don't know anything. You made a big mistake by letting me in here. And they said, well, look, you've scored in the upper 1% of every test you've ever taken. I said, those tests don't measure intelligence, and if you think they do, then you're stupid too, And so I decided I was going to jump off the, I lived in this apartment complex in Houston that only anyone who's ever been in Texas can fully appreciate as, this soulless concrete jungle kind of place. And it happened to be right across the street from the Houston Oilers football team practice field. So there was a big oil derrick there, and I was just going to jump off and then find peace that way. And then I realized that my parents would not be happy if I did that. And so I decided I was going to get really drunk and run into the side of a bridge and then wait to just look like I got drunk, like so many kids in college do, and had an accident. And then they'd be sad, but they wouldn't be that as sad as if they thought I'd killed myself. And I was all ready to do that. And then I was so profoundly depressed for two reasons. Not only because I thought I was stupid, which again, the idea is that anything that causes suffering can be transformative or it can kill you, depending on how you deal with it. So for me, it was about to kill me. And I was depressed not only because I thought I was a fraud and stupid and somehow just, you know, managed to fool people. Now that I was with really smart people, it was just a matter of time before they figured this out. But also I had this kind of existential, kind of spiritual revelation that was more than I could handle at the age of 19, which was that nothing can bring you lasting happiness. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, if I just get married and get rich and famous and all the things that our culture tells us will bring happiness, then I'll be happy. But then I thought, no, I won't be. And so it was profoundly depressed. I just knew that from this experiential understanding that. And so the combination of feeling like I was never going to amount to anything, and even if I did, it wouldn't matter anyway, was profoundly depressing. So that's when I decided I was going to kill myself. What happened was that I got so run down from being up and abusing myself that I got such a bad case of mononucleosis that I literally didn't have the energy to kill myself. So then my parents realized that all was not well with their son, so they came and saw what a mess I was. So they took me home to Dallas, and my plan was to get well enough to kill myself. So, and when you're, see, the thing about being depressed as opposed to just being sad is that when you're sad, you feel like I'm sad, but, you know, I'll be better later, you know. When you're profoundly depressed, it's a psychotic state. And William Styron wrote about this in his book called Darkness Visible. When you're profoundly depressed, you are convinced that you are, I mean, you really see the world through shit-colored glasses. I mean, you're convinced that you, not only are you not happy now, but you will never be happy. And all the times you ever thought you'd be happy, you were just deluding yourself. That's where the hallmarks of being profoundly depressed are helplessness and hopelessness. And that's where it comes from. It's like, if you're never going to be happy, you feel helpless and hopeless. So that's how I was. Now, this was 1972. And my parents, my older sister had been at Washington University in St. Louis and had been, like so many people in the late 60s, a child of the 60s, and had gone from, you know, doing the kinds of things people were doing. And she got involved with yoga, and it really changed her life. And so my parents decided that they would have a cocktail party for the Swami that she'd been studying with, a man named Swami Satchidananda, which was pretty weird back in 1972, especially in Dallas, for those of you from Texas. And so, and I was home recuperating, waiting to get well enough to kill myself. And so in walks this Swami. And there's an old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And that was certainly true for me. And he walked in, and he sat down in a living room, gave a satsang, a lecture. And he started off by saying, nothing can bring you lasting happiness. Well, I'd already figured that one out. But I was miserable, and he was radiant. And I thought, what's wrong with this picture, you know? And then he went on to say what sounds like a New Age cliche, but it really turned my life around, which is that nothing can bring you lasting happiness, but you have it already until you disturb it. And not being mindful of that, and what I think is the ultimate irony in life, is we run after all these things with power and name and fame and recognition and money and so on, thinking they're going to bring us those things. What I mentioned earlier, if only I had more whatever, then I'd be happy. For me, if only I could get into medical school, then I'd be happy. And they realize that it doesn't. And so in the process of running after these things that we think are going to bring us a sense of peace and happiness, we disturb what we have already, but we're not mindful of that. And so that's the ultimate irony, really. It's like running your hand over a bowl of water trying to smooth out the waves, and you just end up creating all these waves. So the Swami said, you know, if you, you know, eat a healthier diet and meditate and do yoga and exercise and do all these things, basically, they don't bring you peace and well-being, but they quiet down your mind and body enough so you can experience that that's your natural state. And when you get past all of the different religions and the forms and all the things that people are killing themselves and all the terrorist stuff is going on in the world, the ultimate essence of, and again, in my limited understanding of all spiritual, all religions, is this, that peace of mind is not something you get. It's something you have already if you just stop disturbing it. This Swami that I studied with, and so I began, I said, you know, I can always, let me try this first. I can always go to plan A, which was to kill myself. Let me try this first and see if there's any merit to it. And so I began to give up my Texas diet of, you know, cheeseburgers and chilies and chalupas, and I started eating a much healthier diet and began to meditate and so on. And I began to get little glimpses of what it felt to feel peaceful, which was a new experience for me. And to realize that the peace didn't come because it wasn't like the meditation was another form of Valium that was quieting down my mind or brought me peace. It was that I was no longer, just for a moment at least, disturbing what's really our natural state. Is this making sense so far? And so, and the Swami later on, so I began studying with him for like 30 some odd years. And people would say to him, sometimes we'd be walking down the street, people would say, what are you, a Hindu? He'd say, no, I'm an undo, you know. Because it's not about doing something, it's about letting go of what's creating suffering in our lives. And so when we can learn to let go, it's like he would say things, I'd call him up and I'd complain about my girlfriend at the time. I'd say, oh, she's doing this and she's not doing that. And then there'd be this long silence, and then he'd start laughing. You know, I'd say, it's not funny. You know, this is really causing me a lot of pain. He'd say, look, if I gave you a... He said, it's not her, it's you. I said, no, it's not me, it's her. She's doing this and she's not doing that. He said, no, it's you. And as long as you think it's her, you're going to keep suffering. He said, if I gave you a hot plate, you know, and you're holding on to it, talking about how much you're suffering, you just let go of it. You know, the pain becomes the catalyst for the transformation, for letting go of these things. And so I began to experience these things. And I got enough of a glimpse that just making the connection between when I was suffering and why transformed the nature of suffering. Because it wasn't punishment. It wasn't like I was not good enough or smart enough or whatever enough. The suffering became the teacher. It's like saying, hey, listen up. Pay attention. You're not doing something that's in your best interest. Okay, and then when we can make the connection between when we suffer and why we suffer, then the suffering can help us transform. Because then you say, well, yeah, I could do this, but wow, you know, okay, when I do this, I feel bad. When I do this, I feel good. And it's not even so much the doing or the actions. It's really the view of the world that leads to those actions that really needs to be changed. The belief that somehow, if only I have more money, more power, more sex, more beauty, more whatever, then I'll be happy. That, to me, is where it all begins. Now, the paradox of all of this is that when I thought I had to get all these things so I could pass organic chemistry, get into medical school, be a doctor, so then people would love me and then I wouldn't feel so lonely and depressed, I couldn't even read a headline and tell you 5 minutes later what it said. I was so depressed. But once I began more inwardly defined, then I could go out in the world and accomplish so much more. But the intention behind it was very different. There's an old Zen proverb, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. In other words, your actions are the same, but the motivation, the intention behind it is very different. If it's for, I've got to get these things so I can be powerful and famous so that people will then love and respect me, you're just setting yourself up for more suffering. But if it's like, I already know that I'm at peace, then I can go out in the world and do these things for service. And then service is what all spiritual traditions talk about. Altruism, compassion, forgiveness. Why? Because that's what frees us from our suffering. It's not about getting a gold star or a good karma or going to heaven. Who knows about those things later? But right here and now, that's what frees us from our suffering. It's when we can let go of those things that we are creating. And so, for me, that was my doorway. And then later when I went to medical school, and then I ended up doing really well in school as a result of that, and gave the baccalaureate and all this stuff. And so it was like an extreme. Like on the one hand, I couldn't even, you know, function or read a headline. And then I began doing really well. And the person who has the most power in this world is not the President of the United States or anyone like that. Because if you spend any time with really powerful people like that, you see that they're really pretty stressed out and often unhappy. I mean, look how presidents aged in the 4 or 8 years that they're in office. I mean, it's visible. You can see it. The person who has the most power is the one who can walk away from anything. I mean, that's really is what being a monk is all about, whether you're a Swami or a Benedictine monk or a nun or whatever, is the more you can walk away from, the less you need, the more power you have. People say, if you don't do this, I'm not going to give you that. You say, that's okay. I don't need that. Well, if you don't do this, I'm not going to give you, I'm not going to promote you. I'm not going to give you. Well, that would be nice. I'd like that, but I don't really need that. And so all of you know is that, and for me at least, the more I needed it, the more anxious I became, the more ineffective I became. If you go to a store and you want to buy something and someone gives you the hard sell and they feel like, you know, that guy's going to just crumple and die if I don't buy this product, you don't want to buy it. You know, you feel resentful. If someone says, well, I'm here to serve you. I'm here to show you why this is a good product because I think it can help you. But if you don't like it, that's okay. those are the people that at least I'm the most likely to buy from, because then you feel free when you're around them. You feel empowered. So when I went to medical school, and I went to medical school at Baylor in Houston, and I was doing my surgery training with Michael DeBakey, the heart surgeon. And so we'd cut people open, we'd bypass their blocked arteries, and they'd go home and they'd eat the same food and not manage stress and not exercise. And more often than not, they'd come back a few months or a year or two later, their bypasses had clogged up. So we'd cut them open again and do the same thing. And it became for me a metaphor of literally bypassing the problem rather than treating the cause. When I lecture, sometimes I'll show a slide of doctors busily mopping up the floor around a sink that's overflowing, but nobody's turning off the faucet. So I thought, well, what is the cause then? What is the faucet that needs to be turned off? Well, clearly diet and exercise and smoking and all these things are important. But it's very hard to change your diet if you feel depressed. You know, it's very hard to quit smoking if you've got 20 friends in that pack of cigarettes. And the patient said, these are my friends. What are you gonna take away my 20 friends? What are you gonna give me instead? And so to me, the farther back in that causal chain of events that you can go, the more powerful and more transformative the healing can be. You say, why do people smoke? Why do they overeat? Well, we talked about it, because they feel lonely and depressed. And so these techniques are really designed to give you that direct experience of what it means to feel at peace and connected. Now, if you take them even further, they give you the sense of transcendence, that on one level, you're you and I'm me. You know, on one level, we're separate. On another level, we're part of something larger that connects us all. And again, all spiritual traditions talk about this. And I think to the degree that we can maintain that double vision, it allows us to act and be in the world in a much more effective way. Now, I've covered a lot of stuff here, and I just wanted to open it up now more for a dialogue, because I think that, you know, we have a small enough group here that we can make this more of an interplay than me just talking to you. Yeah.
I thank you so much for sharing your personal story. It's very inspirational. I'm curious, what I hear you describing is, of course, going inward and then detaching and then going outward into the world and experiencing it. You talked about how monks have so much power in walking away. What invoked you once this kind of enlightened thought occurred to go back into the world and make such significant contributions with your work?
Well, I appreciate the question, because I think that's why we're here. That's what brings meaning in my life. It doesn't bring the peace, because I'm not peaceful all the time. I make the same mistakes everybody does. But when I suffer, the suffering reminds me that I'm looking in the wrong. I still think, oh, if I could just do this, then I'd be happy, you know. If I could just give a good lecture here today, then I'll be happy. Like, wait a minute, that's kind of ridiculous. You know, that's what I'm talking about. So when I forget and I suffer, whether it's anxiety or something more than that, the suffering reminds me, and then it's an iterative process in a way. But I think that all spiritual traditions talk about altruism as one pathway and service, whether it's mentoring, whether it's whatever way you do that. And forgiveness is another powerful way of doing it. So when I can let go, again, it doesn't excuse what someone did. I mean, the whole message of most spiritual traditions, whether Christianity, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You know, it's all about, whether you look at Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela or Gandhi or any of the great spiritual leaders of the 20th century, why do we admire them so much? Because they had something that was bigger than their own self, that they were willing to not only live for, but even to die for. And I think that presents a sense of meaning. So I think that's why we're here, is ultimately to help each other and to serve each other. And it transforms the idea of service from something that's dry and boring to something that's holy, not and sacred. Not in the sense of dry and boring and sacred and like, oh, you know, the dusty, religious texts, but rather sacred in the sense of that's what's the most special. It's like, why make a commitment to be monogamous when you're in a relationship with someone? I just got married 3 weeks ago to Anne, and it's been the most transformative experience of my life, because it's like, sacred is like the most special. It's the most fun. It's the most joyful. And people, I didn't realize that. You know, I'm a child of the 60s too, and I thought, you know, the more people you can be with and go out with and have sex with, the more fun it is, right? I mean, that's the whole Playboy philosophy. It's the whole philosophy of so much of our culture. And yet you realize that it's kind of not that fun. It's like having the same kind of meaningless experience with a lot of people versus having totally different and transformative and really fun experiences with the same person. So there's no point in giving up something that you enjoy unless you get something back that's better, whether it's diet or whether it's not smoking or whether it's, you know, being committed to a monogamous relationship or committed to a cause that's higher than yourself, whether it's civil rights or whether it's apartheid or whether it's freedom from the British in India or whatever it is. Those are the people that we admire, are the people who are willing to say, wait a minute, there's something bigger here. And if you talk with people who've had near-death experiences, and being a doctor, I've had that opportunity many times, they come back and what do they tell you? They don't say, what matters is how much money you made or how much power you accumulated or how many people knew your name in the world. What matters is how much love you gave and how much love you received. And that we're here to learn to love better and to grow in wisdom. Now that may sound like so Marin County, and I'm from Marin County. I'm from Texas originally, but I live in Marin County, and it is Marin County. But it's true. And it's easy to make fun of all these things, but they're true. And I had to find them out for myself. And I'm glad that I did, because when I decided not to kill myself, you know, lo these many years ago, I decided, well, if I'm going to live, I want to live as fully as I can. And whatever wisdom I get, I want it to come from my own experience, which means I have to lead a really messy life and make a lot of stupid mistakes so I can learn from them. Because I don't want to borrow anybody's wisdom. I'd already done that and it almost killed me. I want to learn for myself. And so I really think there's merit in being willing to make stupid mistakes, because then you learn from them. You know, as long as they don't kill you. But even if that, you know, maybe you come back the next time, you learn from them that way. And so I think that's why we're here, is to learn to love better and to grow in wisdom. And everything just becomes a vehicle for that. And so forgiveness is a very empowering thing. Because, I mean, the very first study I did when I was a medical student, and then later when I was at Harvard and at Mass General, found that we did another study. It was the same kind of thing. But the very first day of the first study, I had a 75-year-old. I took 10 patients and I put them in the Plaza Hotel in Houston for a month because they donated the space to us to see if we could reverse heart disease. They thought that was a crazy idea because no one at the time it was thought once you had heart disease it could only get worse. I said, well, in dogs and cats and pigs and rabbits and monkeys you can reverse it. Why not people? You put dogs under stress, they get more blockage independent of their diet. You put them on a high-fat diet, they get blockage. You make them smoke, they get blocked. You stop doing those things. Your body has a remarkable capacity to begin healing itself. And much more quickly than people had once realized, if you just stop doing, turn off the faucet around the sink, so just stop doing what's causing the problem. So I said, let's find out. I said, whatever we show, it'll be interesting. And so I took 10 men and women, put them in a hotel for a month, and I thought, let's put them through this whole program, see what happens. So there was one guy who was a 75-year-old dentist named Arthur, and a guy who was who hated gay people. And, of course, we had a gay person in the study named Oliver. And so they started yelling at each other, and they actually almost came to blows. And one of them clutched his chest because he had such bad angina and started taking nitroglycerin. The other one took Demerol, and they slammed out of the room, slammed the door, ran out of the room. I thought, this is going to be the end of my very short research career. You know, this is the very first day of my first study. This is back in 1977. And then I thought, I brought them together. I said, look, you're giving to the person that you hate the most the power to cause you to have chest pain and maybe even to kill you. That's not smart. You're giving to the person you hate the most the power to kill you. You don't have to do that. So I said, this is a study. You know, I was a second-year medical student at the time. I don't know that I would have done this now, but, you know, you'll do things when you're a student you wouldn't do if you knew better. So I said, part of your goal here is not just to eat a healthy diet and meditate. I'm going to give you homework assignments to do for each other every day. So I'd have them like doing each other's laundry and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I said, and I want you to do this not to benefit the other person, but to benefit you. Because this is what's going to free you from your own suffering. Not only your angina, but the deeper suffering. This may keep you alive. And they never became fast friends, but in the next study, but they never had any more chest pain either, and their heart disease reversed. And in a study that we did in San Francisco, same thing. We had a guy named Dwayne Butler, who is chapter 2 of the Reversing Heart Disease book, who used to go out, he's a self-described Texas redneck, who used to go out and beat people up for fun, particularly if they were black or gay or Jewish or anything that wasn't like him. And so one of the guys in our study, of course, was a gay Episcopal priest. And so we had the same kind of dynamic going there, and that by the end of the first week, he got it completely, and they were like, you know, giving each other hugs. And he never had any more pain, and his heart disease reversed, and so did the priest. And so these are very powerful things that can transform you, but they empower you in a very worldly sense as well as in a more esoteric sense. They free us from our suffering. And so when someone does something bad, it doesn't excuse what they did or condone it for me to forgive them, but it frees me. What I'm letting go of is the suffering, you know, because I don't want to to carry that around with me. I don't want to bring that into my heart. I don't want to bring that into my life. I want to just let go of it, and then I can really enjoy the peace that's in the present moment. Because as the Swami said, it's not them, it's me. Not as a way of blaming myself, but as a way of empowering myself. Because if it's them, what can I do? You know, it's like, well, just be a victim, right? I don't want to be a victim. But if it's me, I can do something about it. And so it's empowering. So all the great spiritual truths that Aldous Huxley talked about, forgiveness, altruism, compassion, service, love, these are things that were... medical grand rounds with the Swami that I studied with before he died a few years ago at the University of Virginia Medical School in Charlottesville. And somebody said, hey, Swami, what's the difference between illness and wellness? And he wrote the word illness, and he circled the first letter, I, and he wrote the word wellness, and he circled the first two letters, the we, you know, which is kind of a shorthand. It's been my experience, you probably have found this to be true, that the people who don't know very much and the people who know a whole lot sound a lot alike, you know, because they say things in a very simple way, in a way that anybody can understand. Now, one is out of ignorance, and one is a profound understanding of it. And so that's a nice shorthand. You know, when you go from the I as a separate, isolated, disconnected, alienated self to the sense of connection and community that comes from bringing people together, it's the most powerful force in human, in my limited understanding. And people will die for that. It's more powerful than eating and breathing and sleeping. You know, if you talk to people who are in the military, they'll often tell you that the most powerful times they had were when they were fighting next to someone. They owe their life to that person because, you know, there's an intimacy that comes when you're under attack. I only say this secondhand because I can't speak from my own experience, but from what many people have told me, that you will die for your army buddy, for your comrade. It can be perverted in a negative way in cults. You know, one of the most easy ways of developing a sense of community is to develop an enemy. And if you can have a common enemy, then it brings you together. But it's not a real sense of intimacy because it gets more and more balkanized. And George Lucas, who did the Star Wars trilogy, now it's six movies, was interviewed. And he said, you know, there could only be Darth Vader's teacher, and then there would be Darth Vader, because it always gets balkanized down to two people and then down to one. You know, because if you find intimacy based on hating someone, it always breaks down into smaller and smaller groups. To me, that's what's happening in the world in general now. And certain politicians, you know, try to create common enemies as a way of getting political power, or, you know, finding a common enemy, whether it was in the Cold War with the communists or whether it's the terrorists or whomever. Not to say that there aren't real problems in the world, but they can be exploited in a way that can temporarily give someone a sense of power because they create a sense of bond over a common enemy. But that's, you know, just like you can get a sense of real power by shooting somebody. You know, it's a real sense of power, but it's a short-lived kind of power. It's not real power. Real power comes by letting go of these things, by not needing them, by creating a sense of connection and community and love and intimacy. And it's harder sometimes to do that, but it's ultimately more sustainable. Those are the people that we remember, that we cherish, the ones that I mentioned, these spiritual leaders, not the ones that prey on our lowest fears and feelings. And so a lot of cults are based on, you know, we're here and we're against them. You know, you can get somebody to castrate yourself, this one cult in San Diego, you know, or put a poison gas in the Tokyo subways or whatever it is, because they're appealing to that same basic need that we all have for connection and community. And the real illness, the depression, to me, of the 21st and late 20th century, has come from that breakdown of the social networks that used to give us a sense of connection and community. Most people don't have a neighborhood where you know your neighbors. You don't have a church or synagogue you go to regularly. You don't have an extended family or even a nuclear family that you see regularly. You don't have a job that feels secure that you've been at it many years. And we all know that these things affect the quality of our lives, but they actually affect our survival and to a much larger degree than we had once thought. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
In response, I just thought it would be worthwhile adding loving kindness for self first, and then through that lens being able to have loving kindness for those around us, and through gratitude, the forgiveness into gratitude.
Yeah, well, you know, let me give you a trick question, which is true, though. To which organ does your heart pump blood first? Anybody? Your brain? Nope, that's what I thought. Your stomach? Nope. You know, so I'm not going to ask you. itself. That's right. Your heart pumps blood to itself first through the coronary artery so that it can then take care of the rest of the body. And if your arteries get clogged up and it can't feed itself, the rest of the body doesn't do so well either. And so, you know, there are all these false choices. Am I going to be selfish and look out for number one, or am I going to be selfless and be a martyr? Well, that's not the choice. I'm going to take care of myself so that I can then go out in the world and serve people. And I'm going to serve people not to be a martyr, but because that's fun. That's what frees me from my suffering. Okay? And so that's where the gratitude comes from. So the more I love myself, the more love I have to give other people. You know, the Talmud said, if I'm not for myself, who will be? If I'm only for myself, who am I? And so these are, again, they're very old ideas that you find in all traditions. Yeah.
I think the point of distinction is that our society is just beginning to honor going inward to discover this. And it's in that silence that this wisdom arises to go outward and make a difference coming from those perspectives.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, because to me one of the most powerful aspects of these spiritual traditions is that they quiet your mind and body enough that you can hear your own inner guru, your own inner wisdom, your own inner teacher. Most spiritual traditions talk about the still small voice within that speaks very clearly but very quietly, and it's easily drowned out by the chatter of our minds. You know, all the stuff that we, you know, all your BlackBerries and our cell phones and this, that. It's very rare that we have any downtime to really think about anything. And what I found, and the teacher that I had, this Swami, he said, look, my role as your teacher is to help you, is not to tell you what to do, it's to help you find your own inner teacher. And we all have that. And sometimes it wakes you up at 3 a.m. You go, wow, why didn't I think about that, you know? Because that's the time when your mind finally is quiet enough that you can begin to hear it. But what I have found to be a very powerful technique is, whether you use prayer or meditation or whatever you use to quiet your mind down, whatever contemplative practice, is to then, and you start to feel more peaceful, to just stay in that peace and then to listen to that voice. And I'll ask myself two questions. What am I not paying attention to that I need to pay attention to? Remember, awareness is the first step in any kind of healing. So what am I not paying attention to? And listen. And usually I'll hear an answer. You know, it may speak in a voice, or I might type it into a typewriter, write it down. You know, we all have different ways of communicating with that inner teacher, but it's a very powerful voice. And it almost always serves me correctly. So what am I not paying attention to that I need to pay attention to? And if I have a specific thing that's been troubling me, I'll just ask myself that and listen for the answer. And sometimes I'll hear it and sometimes I don't. If I don't hear the answer, then I'll visualize this barrier that's keeping me from hearing the answer, and it has its own voice. And I'll say, who are you? What do you do? Well, I'm a wall. What do you do? Well, I'm protecting you from information that I don't think you're ready to hear yet. And I'll say, well, why not? I said, well, because you're just not ready. It's too much. I said, well, how about you let me hear it, and if it's too much, then you can come back. And so you can, like, negotiate with these little walls. And often it'll step aside, and then you can hear it again. And those walls usually come from earlier experiences where you really did need it, to, maybe as part of your survival, to protect you from some ancient traumas or whatever. You say, okay, now I'm ready to move past that. And so one of the most powerful approaches is to listen for your own inner wisdom. And everybody has that still small voice within. You had a question.
Or observation. First of all, thank you very much for all that you've said. It's really helped me to think about things in different lights. I think one of the things that was very striking for me as you were talking was this relationship that you had with your teacher, and sort of linking that to the whole notion of community and the importance of other people being there for one to understand one's inner voice, or to hear one's inner voice, or, you know, to enhance your sense of well-being. And I'm not sure if it's a question or observation, but I grew up in West Africa. I grew up in Nigeria, which is, there are all sorts of studies showing that Nigerians are the most happy people in the world, and yet they go through a lot of problems. And one of the things that I'm... Right, exactly, and yet there is a sense of great well-being. And one of the things that I've lived in Europe and now the States for quite a few years, but one of the things that always strikes me about the West, as opposed to West or other parts of Africa, is that it's so much easier to be a part of the community, and the community is not as segregated as it is over here. And I don't mean segregated necessarily in terms of race, which is a form of segregation, but segregation across, what's very striking for me is across age ranges or age, you know. So where I live in San Francisco, I'm usually always with my age set at the moment. And I find that when I go back to West Africa and I'm with older people, younger people, well-being is enhanced whether you like it or not, because you become part of the community. You deal with people who are aging or who are near death, with birth. Anyway, so it's not really a question, it's more of an observation.
I disagree. Let me just build on that. The need for connection and community, again, I'm just going to keep repeating this, is, a to me, a fundamental human need that is more powerful than the need for food and water even. And I mean, you can build whole businesses. I mean, AOL, why did America Online do so well? Because they had chat rooms. You know, why is Starbucks doing so well? Because they have this place, instead of being a fast food place where you... I do a lot of consulting with business. I chair the health and wellness advisory boards of some big companies like McDonald's and PepsiCo and ConAgra and Del Monte and Safeway and so on. This is what I tell them. I say, if you give the message to your customers, we care about you, we care about your health, that's why we're like at McDonald's, these fruit and walnut salad and Asian salad. I help them develop those things because I figure, you know, even incremental change on 50 million customers a day can make a difference. But I said, it's not enough to even just to make good food. You need to tell your customers, why are we doing this? Because we care about you. At AOL, people had a chat room. 25%, there was an article in the New York Times a few days ago, 25% of Americans have not one person to confide in. And like 50% have no more than one, and 75% have no more than two. So it's very different than West Africa, where you have this whole community. And one of the nice things about having a community is that they know you. You know, what happens, Nova did a one-hour documentary on our work years ago. They filmed the first four patients who went through one of our studies. And one of them died during the course of the study. And he told us that he was a former Olympic athlete. That was his arena, literally, was the arena. And it wasn't until after he died that we learned that he'd never been in the Olympics. It was just made up. And we had another guy who drove a gold Eldorado and wore these Brioni suits and, you know, looked like he was wealthy. And he confided in one of our support groups that he was bankrupt, you know. And so our support groups are really designed to recreate that lost sense of community that you're very beautifully talking about, which is a place that's safe enough for you to let down your emotional defenses and say, this is who I am. Now, one of the nice things about an extended family or the kind of community that you're talking about in Nigeria is they know you. They don't just know the good parts of you. They know where you messed up, and you know that they know, and they know that you know that they know, but they're still there for you. And there's something profoundly healing about knowing that somebody knows you authentically and is still there for you. And many people don't have that experience. Even the limited intimacy that you get in a chat room, which is, I mean, let's face it, it's pretty limited, is such a powerful force that that creates a multi-billion-dollar business. At Starbucks, what do? Instead of saying, this is the Dairy Queen, where you come and get your coffee and leave really quickly, or the McDonald's, they give you soft lighting and high-speed internet access and soft couches, and they say, come on, hang out here. And the Starbucks becomes the community for a lot of places, for a lot of people. And it's not that the coffee's any better there than a lot of other places, but people will pay $5 for a cup of coffee just to hang out in a place where they can be with other people. The same is true for a lot of different companies. And so, you know, to me, gossip has a healing value because gossip is just spreading all the secrets around, you know, so people know that, you know, who you are. And so in our groups, they started out as being more of a support group, like sharing types of, you know, shopping tips and running shoes and blah, blah, blah. And even in the very first week of the first study that I did, I realized that I'd unwittingly created this community of people who had nothing in common other than the fact they all had heart disease. But it became very clear that they were all suffering. And the physical suffering was the least of it. They were lonely. They were depressed. Not everybody, but most of them were. And so what we ended up doing was to very intentionally create an environment that encouraged people that it was safe to let down your defenses and talk about who you really are, warts and all, and not to feel, the fear is, if, you know, the reason people create this image of like, I'm a former Olympic athlete, is to say, wow, I'm cool, you're going to love and respect me, then I won't feel so lonely. But when you think about it, you lose doubly. Because until you get the love and respect, you lose. If you don't get it, you lose. And even if you get it, you can't enjoy it because you don't feel like it's for you. It's for this image that you've created. And then you have to be hyper-vigilant about maintaining this image. And that creates its own levels of stress. So to have a place where people can say, you know, I may look like the perfect dad, but my son's on heroin. And someone else can say, and so we tell people, don't give advice on how to fix it. Don't say, well, have you thought about a drug clinic? Like, of course people have thought about that. That just makes you feel even more lonely. But to say, How does it make you feel when someone says that? Or do you have you had a drug? Someone will say, well, gosh, you know, my son's on cocaine, or I used to have a drug problem, or whatever. And suddenly, in that moment, you're no longer alone. Now, it doesn't fix the problem that your kid's on drugs, but it fixed the bigger problem, which is I feel lonely and powerless, and suddenly I'm not alone anymore. And I have a bond with other people, and that bond gives me the strength that I can then go back out and address these issues in a much more constructive way than I would otherwise. And so anything that can help recreate that, again, awareness is the first step in healing. And so if we understand how study after study have shown that people are 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely when they don't have that sense of connection and community, of all causes, literally of all causes, independent of your diet and exercise and genes, then we can do something about it. So if you're working for a company, they say, okay, we want you to move from, you know, this city to that city, and we'll pay you a little more and give you a little more power. And you know, instead of just dragging your whole family along and take them out of school and disrupting your sense of neighborhood and community, you can say, factor that in the equation and say, well, maybe I don't want to do that because I understand that the cost is much greater than I had thought. Or maybe I can reach out and get to know my neighbors a little better. Or I can let go of some of the petty things and the not so petty grievances that I have, because that's going to then free me from my own suffering, open my heart, and allow me to experience more joy and power and well-being. Suddenly, all of those things begin to get factored into the equation of how we live in our lives in ways that we maybe hadn't thought about before. Does that make sense? Is that, yeah. I feel like Oprah here, going around with my microphone.
I also want to raise an interesting observation, and that is one time I was just sitting with friends of mine. We're all in our 40s and 50s, very responsible people, and we come from responsible parents. And we had this discussion about how we would not be a burden to our children. What have we set up and the plans that we've made both financially and also a sense of how we would look for our own health care and so on, so that someday when we get into that situation, we would not be a burden to our children. And we all said that our parents did the same thing. We all had very responsible parents too. They also set themselves up so that they're financially independent and at the right time they move into their assisted care and then whatever. However, it's not always a happy ending because there's distances when people die, you know, or that in the last 6 months of their lives, you could only see them once every 3 weeks because that's where the travel is. And it triggered this thought, and that is, where did we learn to accept the word that we would be burdened in our old age, our children? I mean, just because if your family, that's a very profound relationship. And when you're old, that's when you're most vulnerable. But this sense that when we're most vulnerable, we better look into how we would take care of all of our own needs, and that we would not be dependent, and we would not be burdened. And so if you have that type of thing, connectedness becomes sort of a fake concept. If you feel like you must sort of almost die alone, I mean, not to make it so very graphic.
I think, again, it's all about the awareness. If I think that I'm going to be a burden to my kids, or if I'm a kid and I think my parents are going to be a burden to me, that becomes self-fulfilling. But if I see it as an opportunity for service and a chance to grow and to get closer to people who love me and made a lot of sacrifices for me, it doesn't feel like a sacrifice in this austere, deprived sense, but rather as an opportunity for real joy and healing. Not that there isn't a lot of difficulty and obstacles and so on, but it provides a much larger context for those obstacles. And suddenly they don't seem so difficult as they might have been before.
I have my son's
here, so. Okay. Well, I'm interested getting back to the introduction when you said that diseases can be slowed down and even reversed. And you mentioned cancer and prostate cancer. From a purely scientific point of view, how does that process work? How can cancer itself be reversed through all of these changes?
We did a series of studies, first with heart disease, with increasing scientific rigor, randomized trials published in, you know, Journal of the American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet Circulation, you know, blah, blah, blah. Using these very high-tech, state-of-the-art measures to prove the power of these very low-tech and ancient interventions. Again, to me, it's just a way of raising awareness so that you realize, oh, I can do this. And that, it's like until Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, everybody thought it was impossible. One guy does it, suddenly 4 more did it within 2 months, you know, because it raised these, a lot of these beliefs become self-fulfilling in both positive and negative ways. And so we were able to show that with heart disease. Last fall, we published the first study we did in collaboration with the chair of urology at Sloan Kettering in New York and at UCSF, where we showed you could actually reverse prostate cancer. If it's true for prostate cancer, it'll probably be true for breast cancer. Now, I'm giving a talk tomorrow morning. It's a breakfast thing at 7:45 at the Little Nell, where I'm going to talk about the science of all this stuff, and I'd rather defer that till then. But in simple terms, your body really has a remarkable capacity in many cases to begin healing itself, and much more quickly than people had once realized, if you simply take a combined approach where you're treating all the things that are causing the problem rather than just literally or figuratively bypassing it. Yeah. Go ahead.
Just to follow up on that point, a little while ago I read a book called Younger Next Year. Are you familiar with it? And I was struck by both the practical program and the science behind it, and the theory that if you don't exercise, once you hit 40, up until 40, you got tailwinds. Once you hit 40, you got headwinds. And if you don't exercise, certainly after 40, your body thinks you're dying, and it goes through certain chemical changes to facilitate that. On the other hand, if you do, your body thinks you're growing, and it goes through certain chemical changes to facilitate that. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
It's part of it. It's not just your body. It's your mind. It's all of these things interrelate. And so the goal, I mean, we're all going to die. I don't want to be the first to break the news to you, but the mortality rate is still 100%. It's one per person. So to me, the more important question is not how long we live, but how well we live. And so that really changed. And you know, again, once I kind of, I think there's great value in confronting your own mortality. In most spiritual traditions, certainly most shamanistic traditions, the Tensegrity people will talk more about this in their workshops. When you face your death, it can overcome you, or it can transform you, because it really does clarify things about what's important and what isn't. And so for me, you know, ideally you want to die old as young as possible, you know, that your death, you're kind of going along like this, and maybe the last month, you know, you have this deterioration. It doesn't have to be this slow dwindling away that we so often see in our culture. You had a question.
Yeah, actually, I have two. First of all, is the medical profession generally following this mode of thinking? That's the first one. And the second one is, like, I was very fascinated by what you said. And I don't think society supports us being together. I think the internet makes us be apart.
Yeah. Well, society is who we are, and we can change that. And again, it all comes down to awareness. And as we become more aware, we can change things. And as businesses realize it's good business to care for people, then that changes things too. So we can get out of the, you know, are you in favor or against big corporations? Are you in favor or against the government? Are you in favor? It's like we live in such a balkanized thing. What I love is, like, we've been trying to get Medicare to pay for our reversing heart disease program. And we brought together a coalition of people. When Bill Clinton was president, he was very strongly behind it, but so was Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House. We did a press conference in the Capitol when Medicare announced they were going to do a demonstration project with Charlie Rangel and Dan Burton. And they joked that, you know, this is the only thing they agree on. I mean, it brings people together when we can find common interests that then transcend those barriers that separate us. And so, you know, I write a monthly column now for both Newsweek and for Reader's Digest, because they have so many readers. And I titled one, if you go to newsweek.com, they're all still there. And one I called It's All About the Benjamins, which means it's all about the money. And with all this talk about evidence-based medicine, I mean, cardiology is a perfect example. If you say, what is the evidence that angioplasty prolongs life or prevents heart attacks, the answer is there is none. Even the American Heart Association published a review of all the studies, randomized trials on angioplasty last summer, and their conclusion was that angioplasty does not prevent heart attacks, does not prolong life. Well, $40 billion were spent on angioplasties and stents last year, and yet it doesn't do anything, because that's reimbursable, whereas the kinds of things that we're doing here are not. At least until recently. We've done a series of demonstration projects. We've shown bigger changes in diet and lifestyle, better clinical outcomes, and larger cost savings than anyone's ever shown before. And even with all that and with all this political pressure, it's taken us 14 years of dealing with Medicare. A Mutual of Omaha is covering it, the Blue Cross Blue Shield, there are about 40 companies that are doing it. And we show that we could cut their costs in half in the first year. Now, that's another tipping point, because a lot of companies are finding that their healthcare costs for their employees, which are really disease care costs, are now approaching the point like Starbucks spends more money on healthcare for its employees than they do for coffee beans. And General Motors spends more for healthcare than for steel. Now, with, I work very closely with Safeway, and they've projected in 3 years their healthcare costs are going to be more than their entire profits, which is clearly not sustainable. So there's a tipping point that's being reached here where they're realizing that, again, it's all about treating the cause. And so if you just shorten hospital stays and shift to outpatient surgery and pay doctors less and less to see more and more patients, that doesn't really treat the more fundamental causes of why people get sick. Healthcare costs continue to rise exponentially. The system is having itself is having a heart attack. And so what we're saying is, look, if you can treat the cause, which are really not only diet and lifestyle, but these deeper issues, then we can cut costs in half. And instead of spending 7 minutes on a patient visit, we spend, you know, months with people, and yet it still saves money. And if I went to Medicare and to, you know, Mark McClellan and said, we want to create sanctuaries where people can quiet down their minds and bodies and rediscover inner sources of peace and joy and well-being, they'd say, you know, you're out of here. But if we can say, here are the quantitative arteriograms, and here's the cardiac PET scans, and here's for every dollar you spend, you save two in the first year, then they're at the point now where they've agreed to cover it. We're still trying to work out the details with them. And if Medicare pays for it, everyone will pay for it, and that will transform medical practice and even medical education, because ultimately it comes down to the Benjamins. You know, we do what we paid to do, and we're trained to do what we paid to do. You change reimbursement, you change medical practice and medical education. Okay, we have time for maybe for one last question or comment. Anybody? Did you have your hand raised? I'm sorry. Okay.
When you said earlier that when someone has cancer, and it wasn't necessarily about treating it medically, but treating the cause. And so how do you know what caused prostate cancer, like he mentioned, you know, and what stresses were in your life? And, I mean, how do you determine that?
We don't know what causes it, but we know often what you can do about it. So if we know, for example, that chronic stress can suppress immune function, which is your immune system is what helps to remove cancer, then by creating, by teaching people meditation and yoga, by creating support groups where they can feel safe enough to really talk about what's really going on in their lives and feel that sense of connection and community by putting them, getting them to stop eating the foods that are, that promote cancer. And it's, again, it's not just what you exclude from your diet that's harmful, but also what you include that's beneficial. There are at least 1,000 substances, you know, phytochemicals, bioflavonoids, carotenoids, retinols, on and on, that have anti-cancer, anti-heart disease, even anti-aging properties. Where do you find them? You find them in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, soy products, things like that, fish. So we can create a healing environment. Now, you know, Mother Teresa died of a heart attack. It wasn't because she wasn't loving enough. No matter what you do, there's always an element of genetics and destiny or karma, whatever you want to say. But to a larger degree than people had once realized, it can be affected by making these changes. I'll talk about the science behind it more tomorrow, but I just really wanted to talk about these other aspects, which I don't usually get a chance to talk about, and I wanted to thank you for giving me this opportunity today. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Sorry about your day.